So this is the schedule we're going to be on for the next few weeks. I just want to kind of make you aware of it. I do this every time, but we're of course in chapter 11. We're only going to do the first 35 verses. I hope I get through them today. I'll tell you why in a minute. And then I do a session. These are midweek. I do one Tuesday at Manor Lake, and then I also do not. I don't do anything for Thanksgiving except eat, watch football games. But anyway, happy Thanksgiving to all of you anyway. That's coming up before next week. And then what we'll do is we'll finish chapter 11, and then I'll do Daniel chapter 12, and we'll kind of wrap that all up. There's no wrap up for chapter 11. That was kind of a carryover, I guess, from when I changed, edited this slide. But we'll do the wrap up on December 3rd. After that, by the way, we'll have, I'm going to do one lesson. I think there's, I got to check if it's 1 or 2 weeks, but we're going to do two lessons for Christmas. So I got to back and fill in something between when we end Daniel. And so if it's one lesson, I got my plan. If it's two lessons, I got to think through it a little bit more. But I'll let you know probably next week what it is. So anyway, my calendar memory has escaped me right now. Four. Okay. So let me make a few comments before we get too far into this. Chapter 4, 11, chapters 11 and 12 really represent the fourth and final vision of Daniel. You're probably all saying, I'm glad we're getting finished with Daniel. Fourth and final vision. And so what we're going to see today is the vision that comes in to play. We previewed in chapter 10. It sort of gave us an introduction to the last vision. And remember, the angel came and all of that. But this vision is made up of two parts. And one part, I mean, I've divided it into two parts. It's one vision, but I've divided it into two parts. Everything from verse 1 of chapter 11 through verse 35 take place within about 200 years of the death of Daniel. Everything after verse 35, 36 and on, and chapter 12 all take place in the future. So I've separated them. We're going to try to get the close-in things done today up through verse 35. So I'm going to do that part one today. And so you'll have to bear with me because part one, if you read it, you look at it and you think, boy, I have no idea what he's talking about. But this chapter has really been the source of some of the major issues that the critics have with the book of Daniel. And the reason they have those discussions, I think I mentioned before, is because Daniel is so accurate. Now, you can look at chapter 11 and think, I don't know what he's talking about. But when you lay history on top of it, which I'm going to try to do today, you will see how accurate and actually incredible this vision is. Now, we know that because the prophet is accurate, that doesn't make the book a forgery. It makes the book authentic. Because God's prophets, if they're not accurate, they're not God's prophets. So Daniel is God's prophet, and his work is accurate. So it is kind of interesting. I would say I'm going to cover the things that match up to the verses today. Thank you, Royce. But I would tell you that if you want to go deeper, I'll put in my plug again for this book. Let me go to the next page. This is what it looks like today if you were to go buy it. This is an old version of it. You can tell it's kind of tattered and worn. But what this book does is it starts in Genesis and goes through Revelation, and it takes every chapter of the book and every prophecy that was prophetic when it was written, and it explains them. And so all the way, so you can go through Daniel and read all the twists and turns and all the kings I can't pronounce and all the other things. I'm going to do a highlight of that. But every prophecy in the Bible, John Walvoord was the head of the Dallas Theological Seminary. He was also the head of the, I think they called it the End Times. I forget what it is, but he and Tim LaHaye and a few others came up with this conference that study end times, and you know they had a big deal about that, and he was the head of that for a while. He's passed away a few years ago, but I would just tell you this: don't expect it to sit down and read like a novel, because it doesn't. It's a reference book. But if you want to see the book of Haggai, for example, or Obadiah, and you want to see what it means, and you want to look at the prophecy, this is the book to go to, because that will be very interesting for you to look at. If any of you want to come get it and look at it, you're welcome to do that. I would just recommend that book. I know some of you are interested in prophecy, some of you are not interested in prophecy, but if you're interested in it, I would recommend this book very highly. So I want to say also, before I get into comments about Israel, the verses we're going to look at today really comprise a set of verses about two kingdoms out of Alexander the Great's kingdom. It's the kingdom of Egypt, and it's the kingdom of Syria, or the Seleucid kingdom. Those are the two kingdoms, and they're called the King of the South and the King of the North. And I'll show you why that's the case. But you know, when Alexander passed away or died, his son was an infant, so he didn't have any heirs, and so it was handed off to the regional governors. And there were like six or seven of them. And over power struggles and consolidations, they got down to three over time, started four, and then it got to three. And we see a little bit of this in this discussion today, but just a tangent of it. But you really see the big battle between the Assyrian or the Seleucid kingdom and the Egyptian kingdom, the Ptolemy kingdom. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. It all happens in about 200 years. But of course, before we get to that, we're going to talk about, Don and Marlene are having a little trouble getting in, so let me readmit them. Okay, I'll mute everybody again just to make sure. Okay, so Israel today, I would say, this is probably my thought, not as much theirs, but there's diminishing hope for hostages. There's still about 200 plus hostages, they think. They don't really know. They've got proof of life on several of them, but two of them they had proof of life on were found dead in the tunnels this week. You know, a young girl who was a soldier, 19 or 20 years old, was killed, and a grandmother was killed also, and they just found their bodies in the tunnels. So I think there's some diminishing hope for that. The other thing that makes me think that is there was almost a deal last week on the hostages brokered by Qatar, or however you want to pronounce it. But anyway, that fell through. And I'm thinking one of the reasons it fell through is Israel's expecting 200 hostages. And my bet is 30 or 40 of them are probably alive. The rest of them are probably dead. So I don't really know that, but that's kind of my thought. So it fell apart. So Israel now has stopped 4 hours a day to let civilians go through. And they're carrying white flags and they're walking out. Kind of interesting. Israel is vetting all of the travelers to try to ferret out the terrorists who are trying to sneak out as well, and hostages. And one of the things they've done, because they had some little children with them in one of them last week, and so the Israelis are guarding the tunnels to keep not the tunnels, but the pathway to keep the Arabs from killing them or making them turn back. And so they shouted in Hebrew, if any of you children understand Hebrew, raise your hand or stand up. And so they're trying to get them to stand up, and that way they'll know they're smuggling hostages out. I didn't see whether they actually got any that way, but you know, that's a possibility, I guess. We don't really know. It's a pretty difficult situation all in all. More graphic images are being viewed, and I guess it's kind of sad to say, but Israel has compiled a narrative and videoed it of what happened that day. And they've played it now for the European Parliament. They've played it for senators. They've played it for anybody who will watch it who denies the fact that this happened. And they've got, I can't imagine, you know, they got pictures of children with their heads cut off and tied together and burnt, husbands and wives tied together and burnt. It's devastating. But yet there are people who still deny that any of it happened, you know, that it's all an Israeli fake. So, but we should expect that. They deny the Holocaust as well. And if you've ever been to Europe and you've gone into Auschwitz or Birkenau or any of the other places and actually walked where the train is and seen the ovens and you've seen where they stayed, and it is in the showers where they were all gassed, you'll never be the same after seeing it. It's education, but it's also it really weighs on your mind when you've seen it. The war in the north is about the same. I think Hezbollah is playing an interesting game right now. They're trying to look to Hamas like they're supporting them, but they don't want to support them too big because they don't want Israel to come after them. So what they're doing is they're shooting across the border. They're trying to do a few little things, not big enough that Israel's going to come after them with full force, but they're just going to bomb a few targets. And so that's what's happening. That's kind of staying in place right now. And I'm not sure whether that's a strategy or they're just not prepared yet to take on Israel. I don't know what that's going to be. But we are seeing more terrorists, by the way, show up in the West Bank, or what we would call Samaria and Judea. The Israelis have been very good at sniffing them out. And they have done operations in Jenin, it's two or three of the Nablus, two or three of the Palestinian cities that are controlled by Palestine to try to get out weapons and all that. So that's been fairly successful. I would just say, just continue to pray for Israel, because every day there's more terrorists all around the world that are parading and, you know, honoring what Hamas did and looking at it all right. Even U.S. commentators, I'm sad to say, are making some comments about the parallels between killing women and children and going after terrorists, you know, what Israel's doing in Gaza versus what they did in Israel. And that's kind of a tough thing, because, you know, if the world doesn't see the difference between killing unarmed civilians, butchering them actually in a very dramatic way, and a military force going after its objectives, that is a pretty hard thing to understand. But I would say also the U.S. is being drawn in. There have been more attacks in the bases. The U.S. has been very delicate in how they responded. And again, I don't know whether that's going to last. The U.S. does not want to be drawn into this war. But sooner or later, they're going to have to do something, because there's been a few Americans and contractors that have been killed. A number have been wounded. One stray rocket hit the wrong place and killed some Americans. And the U.S. will have to take action. They can't hide it anymore. So I would just say, keep praying for that whole situation. It's a difficult time.
The 101st and the 82nd could help solve some of that.
They're over there.
They just need some direction to go take care of the problem.
They do. And I think we've done the right things and putting the right assets over there, but somebody's got to pull the trigger and tell them to go. And I don't know what that's going to be, but I wouldn't be surprised any morning to wake up and see where the U.S. has gone into Syria. I also wouldn't be surprised, honestly, to see where Israel has gone into Iran, because, you know, killing off Hamas is one thing, but Iran is the fomenter of all this trouble. And unless they cut the head of the snake off, it'll be back. And I don't know what they're going to do about that. But
perhaps part of the problem would be cutting off the funds from the White House to the Iran.
Well, that would be a big start, wouldn't it? Big start. I think would we give them $9 billion more dollars, or freed up $9 billion more dollars? I don't understand that. I'm surprised America tolerates that, but we've, you know, they've hidden it. They announced that late in the day when nobody's paying attention. So let me just show you a map and then we'll move on. This map on the right-hand side is what I showed last week. And that's kind of where we were last week. Well, you can see today the hospitals are here. That's where this is. So all of this area now is controlled by Israel. These areas, there's nothing in there to control. This is the buffer zone, and this is part of the south. And then this is where, down here, is where they're sending all the refugees. There's also some high-end neighborhoods down here that are all the terrorists live in. And Israel is going through systematically and destroying all the terrorist homes and all the tunnels that lead out of them. So we don't get all the news, but just in 1 week, you can see, although this is not a very big place, and, you know, just consider house-to-house fighting and identifying tunnels and, you know, whack-a-mole, they pop up out of the tunnel, somebody's got to shoot them, and then they have to go in and get all the bombs, and it's amazing what they found. But they have also neutralized hundreds of arms manufacturing things in the tunnels, both rockets and armaments, you know, all the kind of stuff. So they've taken over the hospital now, and they, you know, are not threatening the hospital, but they are going into the tunnels. And the hospital is interesting because what they did, I don't know that they did this, but somebody went in and used plaster and plastered up all the entrances to the tunnels and put tile up there. But when Israel went in with their technology, they could see behind the walls, so they just busted them out. But it's kind of interesting what they're trying to do to hide the fact of how they've operated for years. And I say we'll get a much fuller picture of this, you know, as we go forward. So let me go back and do a quick review of chapter 9 and 10, because I want to set the stage for 11, and then we want to get into it, because I don't want to run short today on this. We've got enough to do next week. So last week we covered the weeks of prophecy scripture. That's the one the pastor talked about a couple of weeks ago. We covered it last week. There's 70 weeks of years, 490 years, between the time when the Jews were told to go back and rebuild the temple until the end comes. And he went on in chapter 9 to talk about 7 weeks and 62 weeks of years, which is 483 years, I'm sorry, which leaves 1 week of years left. So we talked about that, and we talked a little bit about how at the end of that 483 years, we saw Messiah come. I even talked to you about dates and how that showed up to be the Palm Sunday when Christ rode the donkey into, or the colt into Jerusalem. And then the clock stopped. And in Daniel, they're separated. The 7 and the 62 are combined, and then the clock stops. And the clock doesn't start again until something we call the peace treaty. We talked a little bit about the peace treaty and how that spoke to a time far in the future. Well, we're going to see a little more data today on both of that subject, but we're also going to get a little more information, you know, in the weeks to come on what that final 70th week is going to be like. So we saw the people of the ruler to come, who are the Romans, who destroyed the temple. We saw that. The ruler to come was not the Romans at that time. It's the Antichrist. We talked a little bit about the person we call the Antichrist anyway, the little horn that comes out of the Roman Empire. Two different little horns, as confusing as that is. So we saw that will be the whole thing. The clock will start again when that peace treaty is signed. And there's a lot of speculation on the peace treaty side. But in Daniel 9, we read this also. Let me read it starting in verse 26. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be put to death and will have nothing. Doesn't mean he will have nothing. It means he will be doing nothing for himself. He'll be doing it for someone else. Some of your translations are a little clearer than the NIV is on that. The people of the ruler who will come and destroy the city and the sanctuary, the end will come like a flood. War will continue till the end, and desolations have been decreed. Now, he's talking about not only that end of that time there, but the end of the world time. And there's going to be war and rumors of war all through that time. But the wording is not clear as to when one ends and when one begins. We'll see a little more clarity today. But it talks now about the Antichrist. It says, he will confirm a covenant with many for 1/7. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to the sacrifice and offering. And at the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. Now, we studied that in chapter 9. All of that is, I say, just to say that we are at the point now, getting close to the start of the final 7 years, the final, what we call the tribulation period, or the time of Jacob's trouble, or Daniel's 70th week. It's called by a lot of names. So where's the ruler come from? We talked about that. He's the little horn, the Antichrist. When does it start? We talked a little bit about that. It starts when the peace treaty is signed. Now, unmentioned here is the fact that we have a rapture that occurs, and the rapture occurs before the seven-week period begins. At least that's what I believe. That's what the pastor believes. We're called pre-trib believers, and I believe that, and I think the scripture supports that, especially if you read it in a literal fashion, which I do. You can take any scripture and make it allegorical, but the Bible doesn't do that often. When it's allegory, you know it's allegory. It's not, you know, various statements. So I look at the Bible as a literal translation. And if you look at prophecy, you'll understand why we do that, because most prophecy that's been fulfilled has been fulfilled in a very literal fashion. Are we close to it? Yeah, I think we are. What does it mean? We'll get to that. So chapter 10 was just a warm-up. Chapter 10 then, the angel came. I call him the speaking angel. I think he may be Gabriel, but he's not identified. I don't know who he is. But he's, I call him the speaking angel because he speaks to Daniel. And we see when he talks about the angel of Persia and the angel of Greece, we see an allusion to the spiritual warfare that goes on outside of our view, because he was talking about the satanic angels, or the demons, who were responsible to thwart God's plans. And they tried to thwart him in Persia. They tried to thwart him with Greece. Satan's still active, trying to thwart God's plans. But we see a little tiny glimpse into this when this angel says he went to fight those angels, and Michael, the guardian angel of Israel, came to help him. There's a lot of mysticism about angels, and you could go off and do a whole study on angels and the hierarchy of angels and the missions of angels, but you're getting into some pretty fuzzy territory there, because there's really only two angels mentioned by name, and that's Gabriel and Michael. The others that are mentioned all come out, I've mentioned this before, all come out of the Apocrypha or the Book of Enoch, or some of the history books, which are not canonical books, but they're more fanciful books about somebody's idea of it. So when you see all these old Italian paintings of all these, you know, angels that look like Italians, and they've got, you know, wings, and they kind of feminine looking, you know, whatever. It's an artist's rendition. It has nothing to do with what they really look like. We don't really know what they look like, except for a few glimpses. You get a glimpse of this one angel in chapter 10. He doesn't look anything like, you know, that. So he finishes in chapter, at the end of chapter 10, I want to read two verses, the end of chapter 10 and the first verse of chapter 11, because that sets us up for today. So the angel says to Daniel, "Do you know why I have come to you? Soon I will return to fight against the prince of Persia," again, that demon. "And when I go, the prince of Greece will come," the demon, because Greece overtakes Persia. I know it's complicated, but first I'll tell you what is written in the book of truth. We talked about that. And whether that's a real book of truth, or whether the actual text here says the word of truth. Maybe it's a book. Maybe it's just, you know, God's written down the truth somewhere. I don't know what it is, but book of truth is an okay translation. And then he goes off and says, "No one supports me against them except Michael, your prince, meaning the prince of the Jews. And in the first year of Darius the Mede, I took my stand to protect him." So the angel's saying he's going back to defend Darius. Or if you read the actual pronunciation, it's Darius, not Darius. So if you heard, if you listened to that little thing I sent out talking about Alexander the Great, they call this King Darius. Looks like Darius to me, but you can have whichever pronunciation you want. So that gets us to chapter 11. And in chapter 11, verse 2, we begin to see a couple of figures stand out. One is called the King of the North. The other one is called the King of the South. And I'll tell you why that is in a minute. But let me read this and then we'll talk about it. Now then, I'll tell you the truth. Three more kings, get that out of the way there, will arise in Persia, and then a fourth. So he's talking about now the Darius is going to be replaced by three kings in the Persian Empire, just normal king replacement. They die off and, you know, not somebody replace them. And then a fourth who will be far richer than all the others. When he has gained power by his wealth, he'll stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. Now, I don't know whether you remember, but we talked about one of the reasons why the shaggy goat, if you remember him in one of the early versions, came with such anger at Persia is because this king went over and tried to take over Greece. And he defeated Alexander the Great in Macedonia and Philippi and some area over there. And the Greeks were furious about that. But they did beat him back, and he went back to Persia without having conquered it all. So this is the vision of this king actually doing what in history happened, where they actually stir up all the hate. You know, we see this all the time. You see it in today's world. You know, in Turkey, they're stirring up hate against Israel. They're doing it in Gaza. They're doing it in a lot of places. And they tell you lies about what's going on so that your anger will get, you know, up. And then they'll get you to go do what they want you to do. This is not a new phenomenon. It's been going on forever. And so then a mighty king will arise who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. Now, this is the mighty king, Alexander the Great. And he will rule with great power and do as he pleases. But after he has arisen, remember, he died at 32. He conquered Egypt, by the way, when he was 24 years old. So he lived 8 more years. And died. Some people say he died of a disease he got while trying to take India, you know, malaria or something like that. They didn't have any autopsies back then, so nobody really knows what he died from. But he died at 32 years old, healthy guy. And his empire was broken up. We talked about how his empire was broken up into four regions. But then he says it will not go to his descendants. His son was an infant. So it didn't go to him, nor will it have the power he exercised because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. Now, just understand, it was broken up into like 5 or 6 regions. They consolidated into 4, then they consolidated into 3, but none of them individually had the power of the whole kingdom. Alexander was a great general, a great visionary for military conquest. And they all had allegiance to him. But once he was gone, you know, they were their own allegiance, and they, you know, took their head of the country seriously, and they all became kings, even though that took a little bit of while, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. Now, we're going to see a little bit of stuff happen here. Let me just use this map. So this is a map of the empires after Alexander's time. And you can see two things. The Ptolemaic Empire, which was the empire of Egypt, has Egypt. It also has this red line was over here early because they had all the coast, Israel, and all the coastline up into almost into Syria, what we call Syria today. And the Seleucid Empire was really just this area. But then they went over and they conquered the area of Greece as well. And we'll see a little bit of that. And then look who shows up over here in this time. The Romans begin to show up. And of course, they have Italy, and they have a couple of areas down along the coast here, and they have part of Spain. So they have not gone up into Europe yet, but Italy begins to appear. The King of the North in this chapter is the Seleucid Empire. The King of the South is the Ptolemaic or the Egyptian Empire. And the reason for that is, if you look at Israel, let's say Israel's here, Seleucids are to the north, the others are to the south. All directions, when you see directions in the Bible, are from Jerusalem. So when they talk about the king of the far north in Revelation, they're talking about somebody much farther up in the map, which doesn't go up that far, which turns out to be Russia, and it turns out to be all the Caucasus or Caucasus area, where all the, you know, Kyrgyzstan and all the other stands are up in that area. So that's really what they talk about here. But again, north is always north of Israel, south is south of Israel or south of Jerusalem. So king of the north is the Seleucid or the Syrian Empire. The king of the south is Egypt. So just remember that as we go through and read these verses. So the king of the south will become strong, but one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power. Now, I'm going to go to my notes here because I've got it all written out. And if I don't do that, I will confuse the names of some of these people. And I don't want to do that. I knew there was a pen in there somewhere. Don't worry about it. I got another one up here. I knew I'd hidden a pen somewhere, but I didn't clip it on. Okay. So the king of the south becomes strong. Now, one of the first two kingdoms to consolidate was this Ptolemaic kingdom. But if you saw in the little video that I sent out for you, Alexander actually conquered Egypt. And because they hated the Persians so much, they made him pharaoh when he came. And he was, so if you look at the list of pharaohs, if you go into Google and say, show me the pharaoh dynasties or pharaoic dynasties or however you pronounce that in Egypt, you'll see Alexander and two or three descendants of his. And then you'll see the Ptolemaics or the Ptolemies, which was the general that he put in charge. So you see the history actually there. We look at them and think they're Egyptians. Well, they're really not. They're from Greece or some conquered area. So they're not Egyptians. They don't look like Egyptians. But all of that plays in because Egyptians become very cosmopolitan. They're one of the biggest areas over there, certainly one of the most advanced at the time. So one of the guys that was in that empire over in the south was a general. And remember me showing you the map of that little area, Antigonic, I think, what is the name of it? Was the little king that was put up there to take over. I don't know how little he was, but he was the king. His empire was little. And he went up there to take over that part of Greece. Well, this general that worked in the south went up, they fought against this guy, and they took over his kingdom. And this general became the king of that area, which ended up being the Seleucid kingdom. So that's how all of that happens, a little intrigue. But so this verse says, one of his commanders will become even stronger, and he will rule his own kingdom with great power. They're talking about this general who worked for the king of the south, who, when they went up to take over this antagonist kingdom, he left him to be king of it, and he became king of that in the Seleucid Empire. So it's kind of interesting to see how accurate this is. No wonder people had some confusion, because when you look in history, you see that. And so they both start rising in power. But of course, kingdoms that are nearby are always jealous for money and territory and absolute power. So after some years, they become allies. They were allies, but they became strong allies. So to cement that allyship, the king of the south takes one of his daughters, and he sends her up there to become the bride of the king of the north. Being a daughter of the king is a pretty dangerous position back in those times. But, you know, we see it today. If you actually do a study of the British monarchy, they're all Germans and Austrians. They come out of that old Prussian kingdom, you know, and that's where all these royalties are all interconnected in Europe. And they were pretty interconnected here. And they do it because they think if my daughter's up there, he's not going to come kill me, you know. So they do it for alliances. But what happened here is kind of interesting. His daughter's name is Bernice, by the way, Berenice. So she is sent up there, but the king of the north is married. And he's married to a woman named Laodicea, or Laodice, Laodice, which probably means she came from Laodicea, which is up in Turkey. So he puts his wife away and marries this new daughter of the king of the south. Well, that didn't go over real well with some of the people up there. But because the king of the south was more powerful, he did it for the alliance. Well, what happens after that is interesting. It says, but she will not retain her power, he and his power will not last. So what happens is the king of the south dies. And as soon as he dies, the king of the north puts away Bernice and brings his other wife back as queen. And as soon as she established power, she kills her husband, she kills her children, and she kills Bernice and all of the people that came with Bernice over from the king of the south. So, you know, pretty cutthroat, these royalties. So she does not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. This, you know, it's kind of a short circuit, but this really happened. This is all history, and you can go read this if you want to do that. Again, this book, you want to recommend that. In those days, she will be to great betrayed with her royal escort and her father and the one who supported her. So all of the people that had anything to do with her coming to power in the Northern Kingdom were all put to death. And then the wife put her husband to death and put her son to death because she didn't want the son to come take over her position. Now, you know, so she becomes queen, and then she is replaced by another one of the Seleucids up there. And so the kingdom begins to get powerful. But the king of the south is not happy. And what happens there is one from her family line will arise to take her place. Her brother, who's the son of the guy that died, the king of the south that died, rises up, fields a big army, and he goes up to the king of the north and goes into his fortress. And he fights against them and he wins. Well, he doesn't actually kill the king of the north because he and his wife were out of town. They were surveying another part of their kingdom. But he does pillage the place, destroys their infrastructure, and takes all their gold and silver, hauls it off back to Egypt. He will seize their gods, their metal images, their valuable articles of silver and gold, carry them off to Egypt. For some years, he will leave the king of the north alone. I liken this to, you know, before there's been wars between Israel and Gaza, if you remember. And what happens is Israel signs a peace treaty, they go back, Israel goes back about their business, and Gaza goes about building up their army because you didn't kill them. So they're going to come back and they're going to be a force again. So he doesn't kill this king of the north because his anger has been satisfied. So he brings all their stuff back home. But after that, the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south. He comes down along the coast. But he will retreat to his own country. He doesn't get too far. We'll see a little bit about this in a bit. But his sons then prepare for war. They are not happy that his father didn't get to go all the way down to the king of the south. So they prepare for war. They assemble a great army, which will sweep like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as the fortress of the king of the south. So you can see kind of this happens in waves. So now the army of the king of the north is down by the king of the south in Egypt. They didn't have intelligence back then. They didn't have drones. They didn't have satellites. They didn't know who was sneaking up on them until they got close. So then the king of the south will march out in a rage. Everybody's got a rage. King of the south is ticked off that they've come through his territory and taken a lot of it. So he gathers his army and he goes out to fight against this king of the north, who also has a large army, but it will be defeated. The king of the north will be defeated in this battle. Now, if you know battles, you know the kings always sit up on the mountaintop and they say, left flank go in, right flank go in. So when the battle starts going south, the king of the north gets on his camel or his horse or whatever he had, and heads north, heads home. He gets out of Dodge, and yet all thousands were killed. And it's kind of interesting to me, we value life here. When 100 Americans are killed, it's a big deal for us. When 1,400 Israelis are killed, it's a big deal for them. They don't look at death as an incidental thing. But yet, in that part of the world, 10,000 people can be killed, and you look in wars, and they have been, and life just goes on. Nobody thinks anything about it. It just kind of, they raise their children to be warriors, and if they die in battle, then it's good. Different mentality than we have in the West, for sure. So the king of the north goes back, and what does he do? He musters another army larger than the first, and after several years, he'll advance with a huge army fully equipped. It sounds like deja vu all over again, right? To quote Dizzy Dean, I guess. Yogi Berra. I knew it was one of them. Yogi Berra.
One of those Yankees.
And so anyway, it's kind of interesting. They don't kill each other off. They just go back and they nurse their wounds. And picture this for a minute. They go into these villages and they conscript every male that's in there that's old enough to fight. I mean, some of them are probably 14, 15 years old. And so they decimate their own country, but they raise an army of 200,000 or 300,000 men, and they're just like cannon fodder, and they take them down to do battle. Give them a sword, give them a shield, put them on a horse, and send them south. And so the king of the north musters this large army, and he's again coming down to the king of the south. And in those times, many will rise against the king of the south. Those are violent, and now the angel gives Daniel, remember, this is the angel talking to Daniel. So the angel gives Daniel a little insight into the Jews here. Those who are violent among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. Anybody ever heard the term Sicari? Sicari is a term that means assassin. And the original Sicaris were Israeli or were Jews. And what they would do is they would go through when the Romans would be there, and they would have these knives hidden in their cloaks. And when nobody was looking, they'd slip up behind a Roman and slit his throat and then walk away into the crowd. And that became a way of life. Now, I don't think they were named that because of Israelis, but this was a common feature of the battle strategies over there. Knives are still pretty interesting war weapons. For personal combat close in. And all through the Middle East, knives are used. All through the upper part, like Bulgaria and all that, the choice weapon of assassins is knives, if it's got to be quiet. And so he's telling Daniel that there will be a group of Jews who are so violent that they will go out as assassins and try to throw off the Seleucid Egyptian king, but they'll have no success at all if you're doing that. And we see they do have success later, because in the book of Maccabees, they do throw off the Seleucid Empire and retain Israel for 100 years as locally run. So, and we see that today, as much as we don't like it. If you watch Israel today and you look at terrorism, you will find an occasional Israeli that will go off the wagon and take a knife or a gun and go into a Palestinian area and kill somebody. Even they kill Christians occasionally, because they don't want Christians coming in and proselytizing the Jews to become Christians. There's not very many of them, and the government keeps a real tight thumb on them. But there are some still in Israel. And understand, it's a tribal society, so they're not. It's not like they're steeped in thousands of years of Western type rule, although we have people that are crazy like that too. It's not really a unique thing. But, the Game of Thrones is going full blast here. Everybody's out to get somebody else, and they're out to steal their territory. And so the king of the north will come. Now, he doesn't come to Egypt, but he comes to Sidon. If you know where Sidon is, it's up on the coast. It's part of Syria today, Syria and Tidon. sire, Sidon, and Tyre. Get them mixed up. I'm off my notes now, so we'll see about that. If I can find them again. And they build a siege ramp. You know what a siege ramp is? Have you ever studied Roman history? A siege ramp. I mean, Romans didn't invent it, but they certainly perfected it. If you've been to Israel, how many of you have been to Israel? Did you go to Masada?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to come back to this in a minute, but I'm going to move. This is Masada over here on the left-hand side. Get my cursor removed. And this is King Herod's fortress, and it spans up and down this hill, and it's way up on a mountain. And what the interesting thing about it is, if you look at the Dead Sea, this says Perea Nabatea, but this was Idumea is the home of the Edomites. King Herod was an Idumean. They're all descendants of Esau. And they also had land over here as well. And so all of this was against the Jews. Herod was against the Jews. So what he did is he built his Masada right here on this mountain so that if things got really hairy, he could slip across this narrow isthmus over here and get over to Edom to escape. Well, in the time of the Maccabees, the final revolt of Israel, they took over his temple because they had the same idea. But the Romans thwarted them, and what the Romans did is came around and surrounded them. And they took, I don't know, 6 months or a year, and they built this dirt ramp all the way up to the walls so they could roll their chariots, their battering rams, and everything else up this ramp. And they penetrated the wall. You can see where they busted through if you go. And they get in, and of course, then they all come up, and they go in, and they take the city. There's an interesting story there, but anyway, in a normal, like in the breach of Sidon here, they build a siege ramp. They go up and they break through the wall, and then they would send a couple of hundred troops in who would go down and open the doors to the city, and then all of the troops would go in and they take the city that way. So siege ramps were a way to get rid of this whole idea of impenetrable cities with big walls. Of course, they started building moats later, which slowed them down a whole lot. Now, the English were good at that and the French. But so that's what a siege ramp is. So let me go back. So he builds a siege ramp and he will capture a fortified city. And that city turns out to be Sidon. And the forces of the south will be powerless to resist. So they have gotten their coastal lands back. And the best troops will not have the strength to stand. So, you know, they don't have a lot of troops in Sidon, but the king of the north overpowers them and they take it all. And then the invader does as he pleases. And he comes south. No one will be able to stand against him. He will establish himself in the beautiful land. You can guess where that is. The beautiful land is Israel, the promised land, and will have the power to destroy it. So he comes down. They capture all the coastal areas. They come in and they take Israel. Now, Israel doesn't like these. They're not crazy about the Egyptians. But the Egyptians have been good to Israel over time. And the Egyptians, I mean, the Israelis understand that. The Assyrians have never been good to them. They, you know, captured the northern kingdom and all that. But so they side with the Egyptians when the Assyrians come down and try to help the Egyptians throw off. Now, they're not successful, but it does kind of set the tone for what's going to happen next from the king of the north. So the king of the north comes down, but a commander will put an end to his insolence and will turn his insolence back on him. Now, that's pretty interesting to think about. So here's the king of the north coming down the coast, and he gets down to what you might call Lebanon, Syria, Lebanon, or Gaza, or that area of Israel now where Netanya and all that area is. But remember when I showed you the map of the empires, and one of the empires that was kind of up out of the way was the Romans, right? Well, the Romans have come down now, and the Romans have begun to penetrate the Philistine cities in Gaza. And so the Romans are there. So this king of the north comes down, and he runs smack into a Roman general. And the Roman general pulls him out of the crowd, stands him up, takes his sword and draws a circle around him, and tells him he has two choices. He can die there, or he can turn around and go home. So what does he do? He turns around and goes home. But he is humiliated in front of all of his troops, and they all march back up to Assyria. The Romans are beginning to assert their dominance down there, which is kind of interesting. So he's insolent. He's a, you know, powerful king. He's going to go down. And the Romans just turn it right back on him, humiliate him, and send him back home. After this, he will turn back towards the fortresses of his own country, but he will stumble and fall and be seen no more. Now, what's interesting here is on his way back, he decides he's going to go to Elam. And if you remember the maps at all, Elam is part of Persia, but it is close to where Babylon is, where Babylon was. So on the way back, they decide to go plunder a kingdom, kill them all, and steal all their gold. But somehow on the way back, he disappears. He falls, he stumbles, and he's never heard from again. So it kind of tells me that even God, who uses these Gentile kingdoms for his purpose, has a limit. And he was pretty fed up with this guy for what he was doing, especially coming against Israel. So he let him follow his own instincts, and he hung himself, you know, by his own greed and avarice, I guess. I don't know how he died. Some say he was poisoned. I don't know whether that was true or not, but I don't know. It's all conjecture. But so he will stumble and fall, be seen no more. But of course, the kingdom survives. Let me get past this. And his successor, and his name is, if I can, nothing matters a whole lot. He's a Seleucid king also. His name means the benefactor, if I can find it in here. Seleucid Philopater, or Philopater, I don't know how you pronounce it. But it means the Seleucid, the benefactor. So to keep his royal treasuries high, he sends tax collectors out. I'll tell you this little story. I've used this before when I've talked these verses, but Vicki and I are from Kentucky. And there are parts of Kentucky, especially eastern Kentucky, over in the hills, where the moonshine business was a big business, just like probably in North Georgia. And if you came to town in a suit, you were either a preacher, an undertaker, or a revenuer. And it didn't take them very long to figure out which one you were. And if you were a revenuer, you just disappeared. Just disappeared, you know. And so, you know, it'd take them 8-9 months to replace him, and they would disappear again. And I suspect that happened in North Georgia as well. Well, this guy comes to collect his taxes, and it says, you know, you get the idea here. It's not just the tax collector, but the king himself disappears. In a few years, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. And this is the one that was poisoned, I think. He was poisoned by our buddy that we call Antiochus Epiphanes, who is the Antiochus the Fourth. So he's 4 or 5 down in the Seleucid kings. But he takes over. He poisons the king that's there. And he takes over the kingdom. And it says he will be succeeded by a contemptible person. That's Antiochus Epiphanes. Pastor talked about him. He's the little horn of the Greek Empire, the one that comes to power and is wicked. It's kind of a prototype of the Antichrist that we see later. But it's not been given the honor of royalty. And this is an interesting point. Because he took the throne by intrigue, you know, he killed off the other king. Normally, when we watch kingdoms pass, like when Queen Elizabeth passed and King Charles took over, I mean, it's a state affair. You know, they roll out the carriages, the big Rolls Royces, the kings, the jewels, the whole deal. Well, he never got that honor to be the king of the north. They didn't. He took it by force. So he became the king by his own power, not because anybody celebrated him. They didn't like him, but he was king. So he was not given the honor of royalty, which, again, what a precise instruction. Again, this is all prophetic. This doesn't happen for almost 200 years after Daniel passes away. Daniel doesn't understand it. And it says he will invade a kingdom when its people feel security, will seize it through intrigue. That's what he would do. He would actually go into a place, he'd fatten them all up, he'd give them bribes, he'd make them wealthy, he'd leave them alone for a few years, and when they had accumulated wealth, then he would go take it all and take it as part of his kingdom. And it says an overwhelming army will be swept away before him because he takes it. Both it and the prince of the covenant will be destroyed. The prince of the covenant here is the high priest of Israel. So he's called the prince of the covenant because he stands for the law, the covenant of Israel. So an overwhelming army will come down and they'll take the promised land away from the king of the south. Now, you know, again, the Jews here fight with the king of the south, fight on his side because they don't want this guy taken over, but he wins. And of course, he's got a long memory. And so it says, after coming to agreement with him, he'll act deceitfully, and with only a few people, he will rise to power. So let me tell you the thing. So the king of the south is not in Jerusalem when he takes over, but he's been defeated and weak. But the king of the north doesn't want to pursue him all the way into Egypt. So what he does is he signs a peace treaty with him. But, you know, it's a peace treaty kind of among unequals at the time. And the king of the south has no intention of keeping it. But he's got a few people now because he's named his own high priest. He's named his own head of the Sanhedrin or whatever the legal body was there. And with a very few people, he takes control of the beautiful land of Israel. So he rises to power. And then when all the rich provinces feel secure, he'll invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers or forefathers did. So he will begin to take all these empires that the Seleucids have tried and failed for many years to take. He'll distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. So rather than take all the plunder back and keep it, he would give it out to the people that helped him. He bought their loyalty. You'll see where this comes in handy in a minute. Now, I think the next one is kind of interesting. With a large army, he'll stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a large and powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. So this king of the south, this Antiochus, has bought and paid generals within the king of the south. He has bought and paid for them. And so when they come to battle, they turn on their king and they support the king of the south. It's kind of like, you know, he's planted spies who have turned the tables on the king of the south because of the plots against him. Those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. His army will be swept away and many will fall in battles. Now, again, the kings don't kill each other here. So what do? They sit down and they have a peace treaty. And I love this statement. The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the table and lie to each other. I mean, isn't that kind of, you know, peace treaties? They lie. But to no avail, because the end will still come at the appointed time. So they can lie all they want, but God's got the dates written in the book. And when the date comes, whatever is called for happens. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant. He's mad at these Jews for trying to resist him. He'll take action against it and return to his own country. And I'm running out of time, so I got to speed up. I only got a few more verses. At the appointed time, he'll invade the south again. But this time, the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him. Western coastlands. Your Bible may say something different there. Your Bible may say from the land of Kittim, from the land of Chittim, C-H-I-T-T-I-M. That is the island of Cyprus, by the way. And who do you think these ships from the western coastland might be? They're the Romans. The Romans have had enough of this guy. And so they come and they begin and they turn him back. And he now decides he's going to go take it out on the Jews because they're away from the coast. He can go do that. So he returns, he elevates again those who have followed him and those who have walked away from their holy covenant. And, you know, don't we see today in the world, you know, people who swear, I'll use this as a quick analogy, people who swear to be Christians, we see them today walk away from everything that is Christian, and they begin to embrace something different because it's expedient for them, either politically or whatever reason. And so what he does is his forces raise up. I'll short circuit this. He takes a pig and kills it on the altar, spreads the blood all around, desecrates the altar totally, sets up idols in the temple for all of his own idols against the God of Israel. We don't know what happens to the Ark of the Covenant at this point. It's not mentioned. With flattery, he'll corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know God will firmly resist him. Again, there are people who are the remnant of Israel, just like there's a remnant of Christians today that in their churches will not put up with unsound doctrine, but there are people that will put up with unsound doctrine. And I'll say this again, I'm thankful we're in a church where the doctrine of the Lord, the gospel, is preached in full, and we don't walk away from it, we preach it. And I think that's powerful. We've got a pastor and a staff that does that. And then we end part one of the vision. I've got 2 minutes, so let me do this. Those who are wise will instruct many, wise in the ways of the Lord, by the way. For a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. So people who stick up for God are going to be burned, tortured, some killed because of their faith. And when they fall, they'll receive a little help. Not a lot, but they'll receive a little help. And many who are non-sincere will join them. They'll feel pity for them and they'll join them to try to bind up their wounds. Some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. So all of these who stand up for the Lord, even if they're killed, even if they're martyred, they are purified by what they've done. And just like the heat of the fire drives out all the impurities in gold and silver, it's driven out the impurities in those that have stood for the Lord. And they're held clean for the time of the end. So they will be rescued by the Lord at the time of the end. But of course, you know, Jesus hasn't come yet. So they're in the Old Testament process. So that finishes. And I know I didn't say one other thing. One other thing is the king of the north sends his daughter down. Her name is Cleopatra, by the way, to marry the king of the south. Not the same Cleopatra. Cleopatra means me, Cleopatra the first. It means honor, glory of the father. Patra means father. Cleo means. So today people use the name Cleo. It's a name that means glory. But anyway, she goes down when the king of the south, who is the older king, dies. The new king is 7 years old, sends this woman down. I guess she's a young girl. And he expects her to be his ally when he goes to take the king of the south. But she sides with her husband. And she stays with the king of the south. And so you see the Cleopatras begin to show up in Israel. It's kind of interesting, the history, if you ever want to read it. But I left that out because I didn't follow my notes, but I remember it. So I think I got it all in if I missed anything. Any questions or comments? I know we're out of time.
Prophecy is for sure very accurate and important.
Well, it is, and you have to lay history over top of it. Because if you don't, you read it and you say, I have no idea what this means. I mean, what are they even talking about? And of course, Daniel is getting the Cliff's Notes version of history here. He's just getting some of the highlights as it relates to Israel, not the whole historical narrative. But it's interesting. I agree with you. It's fascinating for sure, to use Wendell's word. Yeah, John.
The purpose of this, since nobody really understood it, including Daniel, was to show God's incredible sovereignty to those of us later?
I think his sovereignty and show the truth of prophecy. You can't read Daniel and read history and not understand that the prophecy was literally fulfilled, which gives us hope that what we study in the next 2 weeks, which is the seventh week of Daniel, will be literally fulfilled as well, just as God has called out and on the timeline he's laid out for it. So I think that's right. I think Daniel itself is a book that shows God's sovereignty. And that also shows his willingness to tell us and to prophesy the future. I mean, prophecy is just history written in advance. So, simple way to look at it. Let's have a word of prayer and then we'll dismiss. Lord, thank you for this time. Thank you for the incredible insight that your angel gave to Daniel and him writing it for us. Lord, help us see the prophecy was fulfilled literally. Help us understand that as we look at the signs of the times that the pastor will bring to us today and he has for the last 2 weeks, we are in the period of time leading up to your final victory over sin and depravity. Lord, help us do what you've called us to do. Help us be who you've called us to be. We pray for the pastor that he'll speak his words in the authority and anointment that you've given him, and it'll come and find a home in our hearts. I pray it all in the blessed and holy name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Thank you all.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Thanks for signing.
Yeah, have a good week.
You too.